I have a question.
La soirée « À qui appartiennent les sidas ?» a eu lieu au Kai Studio à Bruxelles le 14 décembre 2023 et interroge les paroles à propos et autour du VIH et des sidas, qui les écoute et qui accueille ces conversations. La première partie de l'événement était réservée à un public en mixité choisie et n'a donc pas été enregistrée. La deuxième partie, « We need to talk », nous avons besoin de parler, et l'enregistrement que vous êtes sur le point d'écouter. Cet événement était le premier moment public organisé dans le cadre du projet intitulé « Des assemblées en Belgique autour des sidas, des archives et des arts ». Ce projet, qui se poursuit en 2024, a pour objectif de penser des processus pour mener des projets sur les sidas, les archives et les arts, fait par et pour des personnes concernées par le sida et le VIH. Nous dirigeons ce projet avec nos agendas trans-PD Bigouin, séropositif, féministe, antiraciste, matérialiste et intersectionnel en santé communautaire. Le projet est coproduit avec l'Abellone, Bouddha Kunstzentrum, le Delta, ERG, École de recherche graphique, Kai Theater et St. Lucas Antwerpen, en Belgique. Nous avons fait le choix de l'assemblée comme œuvre d'art qui inclut son propre public. Dans l'assemblée, nous partageons des savoirs intercommunautaires et autogouvernant notre projet. Au cours de 2023, nous avons organisé d'autres événements avec différents publics, des résidences, des ateliers et un festival artistique intime par et pour des personnes concernées par le VIH et les SIDA, que nous avons intitulé « AIDS Who ». Les questions qui nous animent sont les suivantes. Qui nous écoute? Qui manque? Qui n'est plus présent? À qui sont les SIDA et qui les possède? Nous posons ces questions en deux temps. La première partie intitulée « Instance et consistance, les lesbiennes et les sidas » était un double programme de performance de Fefa Villa et Thalia. Fefa y relata ses expériences au sein de LSD et de la Radicale Gay, deux collectifs lesbiens et PD impliqués dans l'activisme sida et qui publiaient des fanzines trans-PD Bigouin à Madrid dans les années 1990. Thalia parla de sa transition de genre et de sa séroconversion à travers ses expériences de lesbienne trans-radicale à Paris et dans d'autres lieux. Deux peintures de Marnie Sletter, adaptant les œuvres d'art sur les murs de l'ancien bar lesbien Le Madame, ouvert à Bruxelles entre 1981 et 1983, étaient également exposées. Ce double programme n'était accessible qu'à un public en mixité choisie de lesbiennes concernées par le VIH et le sida. La deuxième partie, We Need to Talk, Nous avons besoin de parler, était une discussion sur les sida et le repos entre trois artistes, Emmanuel Cortés, Nixi et Raphaël Kalengayi Jr., qui sont entrés en dialogue avec une petite audience. Cette conversation présentée ici a pour point de départ un canapé qui sert d'amorce à une conversation sur les sida et le repos, car nous avions besoin d'en parler. Le sofa est un support pour trois questions traduites en quatre langues différentes. Elles portent sur notre insistance à divulguer notre statut sérologique, la propriété et la stigmatisation. Le canapé a été créé à partir de matériaux récupérés et les questions y ont été cousues, il a été conçu pour être portable. Cette nuit du 14 décembre 2023, 60% des places pour la deuxième partie de l'événement ont été réservées aux personnes séropositives et aux personnes trans, racisées et lesbiennes, concernées par le VIH et les SIDA. Cette conversation s'est tenue en anglais, elle fut librement guidée par une série de questions proposées par Emmanuel Cortés, inspirées par le SOFA et deux documents préparés par le collectif new-yorkais « What would an HIV doula do ?». Cette série de questions a été distribuée au public et peut être consultée en format PDF avec cet enregistrement.
I will start asking questions. Who owns AIDS? Whose AIDS? Whose AIDS is it? Is it mine? Is it yours? Is it Big Pharma's?
Can we just talk about this kind of subjects openly? Without prejudice and without culpability.
To me, it's like a really powerful thing to be an HIV positive parent.
We all become entangled, like you are saying, when sexuality is exposed to us.
My mom doesn't know I have HIV. It's been 10 years.
There's something I see in my own family and in general. When people know that you are not straight, they are more scared that you have AIDS than straight people. It makes me laugh at the same time, it makes me angry and makes me sad.
How can we make more spaces where we can talk safely about sex, STIs and HIV and AIDS?
Is the people who took care of people who had AIDS or have AIDS, which has been historically often lesbians or other people within the community.
The 12 million people that doesn't have access because of the big pharma, the pharma grid, they also don't have a voice.
What about the sex worker?
Who's missing here today?
I forgot to talk about doctors.
I want to talk about PrEP.
What are the things we can say if we want PrEP? What are the tips, the stories to tell? Who has ideas?
Feel free again to move around. There's many, many comfortable cushions around us. What is at risk for you when you talk about HIV and AIDS? We're going to move on to the next question. The conversation around HIV has changed drastically. The question is, who's listening, who is missing, and who's AIDS? And I say this because these three questions have also led the planning of tonight and the reason why we're here tonight. We not always have the answers to those questions. My name is Emmanuel Cortez. I'm an artist originally from Mexico, raised in Chicago, and now I live and work here in Brussels for the last 7 years. And for the tool for tonight, I've made a sculpture. I've made the sofa that I'm sitting on and that I will now open and reveal as a present to all of you and to myself. But first, I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves. So I'll shut up and let you introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nixie. I am an artist, a parent. I'm HIV positive, trans femme, caregiver, cultural worker also. And my artistic research has centered around, partly around HIV and kinship. Like if we would look at HIV as a genetic code that built itself into your DNA, you can sort of make like a family tree of everyone who has ever been HIV positive. I've used that as a tool to explore different contexts in which HIV has lived and is living.
Hello, my name is Raphael, I'm 36. I was born in Congo and I grew up in Belgium since I was six in 1993. And my point is HIV is because I have sometimes intimate relationship with some men who are so positive. And at the same time, before I made a voluntary in some LGBT association, who fight against homophobia, racism, and HIV. And now it's more than half and 3 years that I work in an association named AIDS Platform Prevention. And I am sensitive about HIV, even for people who are queer or straight or whatever, even in professional and personal life. Voilà.
I'm going to open this. The idea with this sofa is not only to make a sofa and not only to respond to the desire of rest, but it's also a conversation starter, which is why we're here tonight, right? One of the questions that I'd like to start with is about our cultural realities, because we all have very different cultural backgrounds and how those affect the way that we deal with STIs STIs and HIV as a virus and AIDS as a syndrome, and how that is affecting us in our daily lives or how we have encountered those.
For my own experience as a black Congolese man, I remember when I first came in Belgium in 1993, I saw a movie named Philadelphia with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks. And the people who made this movie make bonds between prejudice about homophobia, xenophobia, and racism, because the advocates of the gay men who have HIV is Denzel Washington, is black. I was a very little boy. It was the first time that I heard AIDS, but at home, with my religion and my culture, sexuality was a big taboo. Even I say AIDS as a little boy of 5 and 6 years, my family slapped me, say, you can't say that words. But I saw my parents see this movie, but it was the first time I saw that. And in my family, people around me at church say that there is a lot of HIV in Africa, and this is the disease of gay people. When I was adult, I see people who say to me secretly, I am positive. And because I love to read, I am very curious. I love always to search information when something interests me, as I'm looking at a lot of information. And it was only in 2003, donc 2013, when I was 26, that I learned that there is a treatment for people who are seropositive, so they can live with HIV normally. And it's not a problem, but it took me a long time to understand that. Though I grew up with this mentality, it took me time with my culture and religion.
Yeah, I think me, I was a Mexican American, so I was raised by a Mexican family, and sex itself is very, very taboo, so there was no butterflies and bees talk. Like, I did not have the talk of how I should be safe, and much less the talk about getting tested or going to, you know, find a safe ways to have sex. That was never a discussion in my family, and I was never curious enough to go search it, you know. It was extremely, extremely taboo, and I don't know how I've survived until now.
My education is schizophrenic because there is a lot of taboo, but at the same time, people always do it, hide it. It's very hypocrite. You can go to church and see a preacher man who say, don't do that. But, you know, the preacher man do worse that yourself you can do. And your own parents, your own grandbrothers. Everybody in my family loves sex, but at the same time, we can't talk about sex. And they always use religion to say you that you will go to hell if you think about that. You say some words, and if you are a gay man, and it hurts your mental hurts. You grew up in that and you survive in that. I'm still alive, thank God. But yeah, it's look schizophrenic.
There's something I have to say coming from the United States. We can never have a conversation about HIV and AIDS without talking about racism, without talking about African American experiences. Because unfortunately, as much as we are in a country where HIV and AIDS is somehow controlled, regulated, there's access to medicine, there are still communities that are unequally touched by HIV and AIDS, even in communities, even in societies like in the US or in Europe. And there are communities that we cannot talk about, or that I cannot talk about because I'm not part of that community, or because we don't have access to that community, so I cannot speak for those, but I need to make sure that we are all aware that these communities exist. For example, here in Belgium, there are cases of AIDS happening, and these are communities that are outside of the reach of access to medicine, for example. These are sex workers, these are immigrants who don't have papers, coming from countries that don't give them access to medicine or treatment or pre-exposure treatment, seeking out help. And then when they arrive, they are in a precarious situation already, and they do not have access easily to a simple route to medicine. Mind you, in Belgium, if you're an asylum seeker or an immigrant, you can immediately have access to this. The system that is in place makes it extremely difficult administratively, financially, for anybody to have access. So not knowing exactly how that system works, but knowing that it exists, is already a start. Unfortunately, for many people, it's a reality today. I did not say whether or not I am HIV positive, because I'm tired of saying that. I'd like to kind of maybe start off with a little anecdote that I think many of us have experienced or can relate to. I like tattoos, and I like to walk around, to go and get tattoos in parlors and stuff like this. And when you go to a parlor, there's always a consent form that you have to sign. And this consent form talks about caring for your tattoo and the responsibility that you're taking by going to a tattoo parlor, and that you know the consequences if you don't take care of it, etc. There is, I want to say 90% of the time, a line on there that asks whether you have a disease that is communicable, and HIV and AIDS is always marked as one of those, and you have to say yes or no. Obviously, you can lie, but from my experience, before 10 years ago, that question, I could overlook it, and it was whatever. But as of 2013, that question became extremely violent to me. And every time I get a tattoo in a parlor, and I have to sign this form, I get reminded of something that I don't really care to disclose every time I want to just get a tattoo. And so one of the questions that is on the sofa is, can we take a break from disclosing our HIV status? And to answer that simply, it's yes, I can take a break, I can stop telling you, but at the same time, can we also stop having these instances where you are asked administratively to sign a form that says, yes, I am HIV positive, be careful. If you're doing a tattoo, you take precautions to be safe, and you don't share needles, and you have gloves, and the blood is not an issue. But still, this happens, and it's overlooked every single time. And for years now, in every society that I've lived in, it's common practice to have safety guidelines. And so why are we still being asked? So how is HIV disclosure stigmatized? I mean, maybe in your case or in your case.
I often choose to disclose my status because I also want to, like, for myself, not carry the weight that this is like something that I should not talk about, like in the same way that I might talk about, I don't know, having the flu or other health things where you might take medication for or whatever. However, I find it quite surprising often in like medical context how many doctors seem to be unaware. Like I went for like a teeth cleaning like a few weeks ago. And she asked me, like, oh, are you on medications? And I told yes. And then she was like, ah, yes. Then you have to make sure that you get tested before you come. I was like, like, tested that you're still undetectable. And I was like, okay, girl, like, I'm not going to do that. yeah, that was like a wild moment to me. So in these contexts, I feel, I mean, I'm like, well, if you cannot even be educated within your own profession, what are we doing? But then I feel also... disclosing my status to a lot of people, it might open a conversation sometimes that's like, that can educate people and like really, yeah, that's something that I'm willing to do because I don't mind that much of me. It's kind of like healing, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I feel the same. For me, over the last 10 years, it's been a very, it's changed over time, right? I felt more and more comfortable with saying to my friends that I am positive. I've been more and more comfortable talking about my artwork to my family because I do talk about HIV and AIDS in my work a lot more recently in the last 5 years than before, and it's still very hard, right? So you choose what communities you want to disclose to, and I guess the backlash or the feedback that you get from these different communities is it varies. But like you said, it's empowering. It's some sort of like. Who, like at this point, we answer the question of ownership, right? Like, who owns AIDS? Whose AIDS? Whose AIDS is it? Is it mine? Is it yours? Is it Big Pharma's? Is it this tattoo artist who's asking me every time, like, if I'm HIV positive? Whose AIDS is it, right? This is the question that has been guiding our project as well. This is one of the main questions that we are leading with. And we can answer this in many, many ways. But today, I don't have the answer to it, unfortunately. But you've answered already. In one way. In the conversation we had before, you spoke about caretakers being owners of HIV. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's just something that, I mean, historically, I mean, it's a super erased history that's been colonized and claimed by white men, basically, the story of HIV and AIDS. And in that way, I also feel like an ownership has been taken that's also not theirs to take, which is, I mean, a strange thing. And something that I always find amazingly fascinating is the people who took care of people who had AIDS or have AIDS, which has been historically often lesbians or other people within the community. It's always like this weird intersectional thing, right? If not only you're not an owner of HIV by having it in your body, but also by interacting with it or by maybe even ignoring it, you also own it in a way because you, I mean, especially if you're like a governmental body who can take action, you have a relationship to this thing that exists.
It's very quiet out there. If anybody has any comments or questions, please feel free. There's a mic here. Just reminding everyone. I know you're shy. Maybe you're sleeping because it's too comfortable. That's okay too. But if we cannot talk about HIV and AIDS without talking about African Americans in the US, how do we do that here in Europe? I mean, how do we talk about those that are not here and the people that are missing, right? Who's missing here today in our conversation?
I am surprised that today there is a lot of ignorance about HIV because people think this isn't the best. And a lot of people don't think about that. They have some prejudice. They don't be careful. And they always think like we are in the 18. Always point some population to say that's only this kind of population who share HIV, but we don't have to be scared about that. And we don't have to always show the same people about this subject. Make some research, teach yourself. I learn myself, but at the same time, I try to tell people to teach themselves and make us own research, because nobody can make all the work for other people, because like you say, sometimes you feel tired to always repeat again and again, and you don't want to talk.
And like you said, it's very tiring. This is where the question about rest is for me.
But it's funny because today we have technology, we have internet, but all the information is everywhere, so you can make the choice of what is good and bad. People don't like to read. It's a problem.
And that's valid, you know, not everyone has to read. but I think that's sometimes also where art can be. I mean, I don't think art should be education, but it can make people explore, you know, questions that they might not have thought about. Or, you know, maybe if I've shown my work before, potentially people have gone home and looked up more about HIV/AIDS, and that's, I think that can be a power of artistic work. It doesn't need to be.
I have a question. So how do everyday folk get their information about science, about policy, information that they may need to save their lives? Where does this information come from? Does it come from people? Is it the person that has HIV? I mean, how do you get all the information is out there? Look for stuff that talked about HIV and AIDS to learn how much the culture has changed within the community. I mean,
I'm not going to answer your question, I think.
Okay.
But just before you ask who's not here.
Yeah.
And so I did some research before today of who is concerned with HIV in Belgium currently, and who is concerned by being POS. And in Belgium, the two main communities who are POS are men who have sex with men, which are the most numeric community. And the second more numeric community is heterosexual person coming from migration from sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that within the room tonight, one of the communities is represented, and more than the other, way much more than the other. So it's it makes me think of your question, who is not here today, and also, like, is there in this way different kind of AIDS, because different community and different story about it and different way of community living it.
I mean, I do think, you know, you talked about Black Americans, but also, you know, Black Europeans also carry a colonial history. I mean, we carry this colonial history, and capitalist colonialism is also the reason, partly the reason why sub-Saharan Africa communities are influenced so much. Like, for example, something that I found in my research is that Big Pharma inhibited factories for medication, antiviral medication, to be built, like, for example, in South Africa. I think it was 2006 or something. So it's been a while. Or maybe it was 2000. I don't know. I don't remember. But it was because they still had patent over this medication, so they refused the South African government their question of, can we build our own production line of this medication here so that we can make it accessible to our communities. So yeah, my legacy, my, like, European, yeah, I was born and raised here, like, I do carry, I think, this responsibility to know about this and to know that this is happening and to, I don't know how to fight it, but talking about it can already be a first step, I think. But yeah, I mean, like, for example, now this is not happening anymore, but this is a big part, this has been a big part of this rise in numbers of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa.
I think you raise a really interesting point about ownership here. I mean, in this case, unfortunately, the ownership is in the hands of Big Pharma somehow, in a very negative way, right? But then you also brought up a point about how we can set up spaces spaces to safely talk about sex and prevention and HIV and stigma and all of these things without being looked at in a way that is, I guess, negative. Or, yeah, I mean, sometimes this is like, oh, these are the sick people trying to get some, I don't know, get more information out into the world. Or I feel like today is an experimentation to attempt at doing something in a more safe way, in a more open way. But at the same time, it's difficult to engage in conversation with more people. How can we make more spaces where we can talk safely about sex, STIs, and HIV, and AIDS, so that we can reach more people?
After more than 40 years that we learned the existence of AIDS and HIV, we must have to stop stigmatize always the same community, if you know what I mean, and say that it concerns everybody, and sexual health is for everybody, and don't make culpabilize people about what they do in private or in public. Can we just talk about this kind of subjects openly to everybody without prejudice and without culpability? Des discours moraux, moral discours, je sais pas. moral discourse, yes, but just talk about that like this is something normal and it concerns also straight people, white people. Yeah, this is normal subject about life. Can we just talk about it openly to everybody without culpabilization? Some people are deconstructed, some people that still stay 40 years before. And today we must talk about it like this is something normal.
That's like something, that's why I make this analogy with the flu, for example, because, like, medically you would also speak of seroconversion when you would get the flu, because then you get, like, flu positive, I suppose, like influenza positive. So, I mean, it's just the same. I mean, if you just look at it through that lens, it becomes this thing that's just like, it's just the flu, but then different. Maybe a bit like, you know, you do have to take medication for it your entire life. Or,
But we can say that because we are living in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we can say that because we have papers, and we can say that because we have access to medicine. We are in a privileged country where our reality and our experience is one that allows for us to have these conversations with people, and that we can. My mom doesn't know I have HIV. It's been 10 years. Everybody in my family, well, immediate family knows. My dad was the first one to know, who in a Mexican-American family you would think is the last person you want to tell. Like, my nephews know. But my mom doesn't, you know? And that's because I don't want to have that conversation with her. When I came out to her, it was like, don't get AIDS. How do you tell your child that? I mean, there's many other things that my mom has said that are extremely problematic, and I hope she doesn't listen to this. But, you know, it's hard to have these conversations.
There's something I see in my own family and in general. When people know that you are not straight, they are more scared that you have AIDS than straight people. It makes me laugh at the same time. It makes me angry and makes me sad.
When I like became positive, I was at home when I got sick. So my mom went to the doctors with me, and then the first thing she said was like, when the test came back, she was like, "This is the worst thing that has happened in my life." I was like, "Okay, girl, calm down." But yeah, I mean, I was very privileged and lucky to have also studied medicine, so to have to be aware of the fact that yeah.
Who said that?
My mom.
Your mom said that?
Yeah.
In her life,
yes.
I can relate to that in the sense that the activity that would allow for a safer sex, Manny, would have been a conversation with my mom and dad about sex at a much younger age, you know? So it's really funny that, I mean, you know, like that's how I see her reaction. I don't know how it was for you in being raised as a Congolese man in Belgium.
I grew up in Belgium, so I only have my own experience when I grew up in Belgium. But it was, the values was stronger in my family, in my own Africa community. But I see that in my own African community, it's more violent to talk about that. Even you are queer. I have no HIV, but if when they talk about queerness or HIV, it's very violent. It's my own culture.
And what do you like? How, in what sense? How is it more violent? And more violent than what, if I may ask?
People don't want to talk about that. But like I said, I work in an association who fights against AIDS prevention platform, and we work a lot with some migrants, and some are thankful because themselves they say this is taboo. They are alone, they can talk about that with a family, with a community, but they are happy to see someone, for example, like me, who are black like them, who work in sexual health, and they say, I can talk to an African professional about my sexuality because he can directly understand what they are living. And sometimes it's like in a mirror because when you work and you see some people of color who confide you something personal, and sometimes it's like a mirror because it reminds you your own experience when you were born in Congo, you grew up in Belgium and you have many experience, and it's opened you to a mix of reality will show you different value that you can experience in different social community.
What is that risk for you when you talk about HIV and AIDS, maybe outside of work?
And sometimes you need to have support of people who are black like you, and you wish they can be proud of you, so you feel rejection of your own community, African community sometimes, even they are straight or even they are gay, and you say, guys, girls, I do something important to own my life and for always help people, but you don't see that I do what I can so to help people, and it's even for me. They say, ah, good, I'm happy for you, but at the same time, they are not very serious to support you, and sometimes you feel alone. And even gay people, they don't see how it's important for you, what you do to help people. And this is the risk that I can feel outside my work.
Today I've talked about community a lot. And the HIV positive community is, I cannot say it's a community. I think it's a very isolating situation. Before working on this project, in the last 10 years of my life, being a HIV positive person, had never been in a room with more than two other people who were also positive. And to share that experience, like you said, with someone else that's similar to me in one way or another, and to share just a coming out story of HIV positiveness, it didn't exist for me, you know? In this project, we had an intimate festival, arts festival at La Bellone, where we had invited the community as much as we could, and we were surrounded by people who were concerned with HIV and AIDS, both in the audience and as the artistic. And that was a very important moment in my life where I realized how important it is to have also an HIV positive community, you know? We're working towards making this more normal, I guess, for those of us who are able to do that. But even saying normal is really terrifying, actually. I don't want to normalize our experiences. Our experiences are very, very precarious. Our experiences are very isolated, and our experiences are very, very not good, I have to say. So we're going to move on to the next question. Come on.
And next position. My muscle hurts.
yeah, we're going to move around. Feel free again to move around. There's many, many comfortable cushions around us. How do we account for HIV, for how HIV and AIDS keeps all of our bodies entangled and vulnerable? This is not a gay cancer. This is not just a gay, cis, white man, community-centered virus. This virus does not choose people. So how do we keep that into consideration when we are living our life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very difficult question. Yeah, I think one thing to do is to like decentralize this. I mean, that's like what I tried to do a bit, like decentralize this idea that it's like this gay disease. Talk about mothers and children who are HIV positive. I think this is like also a big community that is often overlooked. Since having a child myself, I mean, I was undetectable, so the virus did not transfer. To me, it's like a really powerful thing to be an HIV positive parent, because I feel like this is a representation that is often overlooked.
Hello, can you hear me? I think we all become entangled, like you are saying, when sexuality is exposed to us, and if we would be approached to this, like, okay, there are these risks, how you minimize these risks is by doing this, and this, have sex with no problem, then know your risks and know the procedures you have to do to be safe, then I think we would all have a way better and more positive connection with our sexuality, and not to see people with this virus or other infections in this so negative and stigmatized way. It's our sexuality, no, is not at least from a port. I had a Portuguese education, so it's a bit taboo, like you were saying, like your moms don't want you to have free sex and will not talk about this with you, and this makes us all somehow connected in this way, and having to explore our sexuality in the best possible way that we find ourselves. And okay, this was my contribution.
Thank
yeah,
you.
That's so it's super true, because also I feel like a lot of gay sex is also based in fear or something. I remember for me as well, like before becoming positive, like it was my biggest fear to get HIV. I mean, and then once I got it, I was like, okay, this is actually fine. But it's also, yeah, it's this representation that is like really shoved down your throat, you know, like you'll get AIDS, you'll die. Yeah, from a very young age, like kind of like you said, like in movies. And yeah, so definitely liberating that.
I want to talk about PrEP and how that's changed the discourse of HIV over the years. PrEP was not accessible here for a long time before. Now when you walk around the city in Chicago, there are huge, huge walls of publicity that are gay people or people that are LGBTQ of all shapes and sizes and forms. And it's a publicity for PrEP. And these are huge, they're like building size PrEP commercials everywhere you go, in Spanish and English, and well, mostly Spanish and English, because those are the two predominant languages in Chicago. But they're everywhere, on the trains, in the tiniest little, like everywhere you go. The conversation around HIV has changed drastically towards something that's a lot happier and hey, you know, we can talk about not getting it or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I think PrEP is like, yeah, definitely a super interesting addition to the narrative of HIV/AIDS. But while it is obviously positive and something that could be beneficial, I also think it's quite interesting to me how it medicalizes, like it's sort of this forced medicalization of people at risk, which is also narrowly defined sometimes. And, you know, you're like, I guess, subject to certain tests. I mean, I'm not sure what the process is to get PrEP, but yeah, I always find this interesting of like, you have to then qualify for it and then mm-hmm. you can get it. And it's like this, it's to me, it's this weird thing. it's this weird power balance or something between these medical caregivers and people who try to access the possibility of not getting infected. Or
it's interesting. My partner is negative. And so he started the process of trying to get on the lottery for getting PrEP right when it started here in Belgium. I don't remember the exact process, but there was a point at which he had to lie in order to get it, because we were at the moment we were monogamous. And if you're monogamous with someone who's on HIV medication, you can't get PrEP. Oh, sorry, we were not monogamous. Hold on, I forget. It wouldn't make sense if we were, anyway. The idea was that he had to lie to get it, because at this point we were not monogamous. I forget. I don't know exactly how that went. The thing is, it was tricky as hell, and he had to lie. And if anybody has had that experience also, that you had to lie, we end up just being a statistic in the books, and most of those are always wrong, and it's just to get PrEP.
Hi. Hello. So maybe I can talk about my own experience with that, because I'm not HIV positive, but I lived, I was in a relationship with a person who was HIV positive. And in the end, this was something that for me, it made it much easier to access PrEP, because at least in Belgium, this was one of the qualifying factors that allowed you to get PrEP, because you were living with someone who had HIV, and they also wanted to study that additionally, because I was also part of the initial study for PrEP in Belgium. And I think in the end, the most discriminated group, which is a bit funny, is that straight people are the most discriminated people when it comes to access to PrEP. That at the moment they are becoming the people who are the most at risk of transmitting HIV, because they are not considered a risk group. So they also don't consider themselves a risk group, so they don't even think about having PrEP. Like, I had many conversations with straight people, with straight colleagues at work or straight friends that don't even know what is PrEP. Where for people within the queer community, everyone will know what it is. Maybe they don't use it, but they at least heard about it. But for straight people, they're like, I have no idea what PrEP is. At the moment, the communities that were the most affected, let's say of course, it's not always the same because the different parts of the community will have different access to it, but the communities that were most affected by this in the past have the best protection at the moment.
I don't know, what about the sex worker?
Yeah, I think sex workers can also access PrEP.
So the question was, what about sex workers and PrEP and norm? Well, if the sex worker is documented, they have access to PrEP. This is why earlier I spoke very quickly about some of the largest communities that are at risk are communities of sex workers and communities of sex workers that are undocumented. I believe, and I please don't quote me on this, but Belgium is working on getting access to those communities, not just for PrEP, but also for HIV medication. The system has not been set up because those communities had not been taken into account until recently when sex work has been decriminalized finally. And so access to certain medications and to certain risk, information about risk is now less stigmatized and less looked down upon in the medical world and in administration and in legal talks, that all of that is starting to be worked out. I am not an expert, but you know, this is the reality of what's happening, and hopefully it gets better and better, and yay for the decriminalization of sex work.
Hi. So I wanna, what we're saying now inspires me one question. Perhaps in between the people in the room, we can give each other tips on what we have to tell doctors to get post-exposition therapy, which is a therapy that lasts a month and that quite highly reduces the possibilities of user or converting if you had a risky practice with someone who's positive and not in medication. And what are the things we can say if we want PrEP? I'm not telling what's the truth, but like what can we say if we want the drug? What are the tips, the stories to tell? Who has ideas?
The mic is up for grabs.
I think usually the biggest factors in this, you have to say that you practice unsafe sex, that you have you're a man who has sex with men, you're a sex worker, so you have to disclose that you're a sex worker, or that you have sex while using drugs. So chemsex is also another factor that is important in getting such medication. And I think it's both for post-exposure and PrEP. I'm not sure if there is a difference. I think PrEP is a bit more difficult to get because it's usually a medication that takes, you have to take a longer period of time, while post-exposure, it's normally you just get a monthly dose of the medication.
Usually PrEP, it should really be an emergency exit. Every organization would not suggest you to if it happens more than once in your life, a person should consider the PrEP because it's less strong on the body, no? And you have to take it for 30 days also, so you have all the side effect that you will only have the first 30 days. And PrEP nowadays you can take it. I'm not sure about it, but if it's one day before and 2 days after, or 2 days before and 2 days after, but I mean, basically you cover the weekend that you have sex and you are covered. But yeah,
I guess it's 10 now. So
yeah,
if anyone wants to like maybe have some closing remarks. Some other things to say.
Only one thing. There was two questions ago. Who owns HIV? I think it's important to remind everybody that, okay, HIV regards everybody that have a sexual activity. So basically, has more or less everybody knows that if you put the red socks in the white washing machine, everybody come out pink. I mean, we should get to the point, no? That we reach this general acknowledgement, yeah, it's not that hard. With COVID was quite easy, so I mean, it's very stupid. So let's burn the church. That's my mess, because that's the problem of the last 40 years. Sorry, yeah. I'm talking from an Italian background, but as we said, the 12 million people that doesn't have access because of the big pharma, the pharma greed, they also don't have a voice. And in the HIV movement lately, because we are very much aware that we cannot speak as a white people over anybody else, or as cisgender people, also, you know, you can only talk about yourself. At this political fight, it's fading out. And I think we have a privilege that we remember that we also have a responsibility and the power, and that HIV is a political crisis. Of course, we have to switch the cultural aspect.
Yeah, I would say to say something for me to finish. Some of you were talking about doctors, but I forgot to talk about doctors. There is so many good doctors who are like angels, but it exists some doctor that we are surprised they are not enough educated. We think that they make study of medicine, and we hope that they more than you than us. But when you go to the doctor, sometimes it's yourself who must make the education of a professional, and it's, for me, scandalous. And I hope that in a medical professional, mentality can be higher about sexual health, HIV, and PrEP. In my own experience, a lot of doctors don't know that PrEP exists. I'm just a social worker, but some doctors don't know that, and you don't have to make the education of the doctor when you go make tests if you need PrEP. Many doctors need to have more formation. It's not the rules, it's the rules of the doctor to open the book. And the society is in evolution, and every professional in his own discipline must make formation to herself.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you for your time and your comments and your questions. And we'll leave it at that. You can look at this beautiful thing. If you're an institution or a cultural worker or an artist that would like to borrow this for an X amount of time, there is an email that you can send to viralmail@proton.me, and we can have a conversation. Voilà. Thank you so much.
Thank you.